Hello, and welcome to Around It About Chattanooga. I am your host, Michael Edward Miller. Today, I'm speaking with someone who's got to be one of the Chattanooga area's most prolific authors. Tim Champlin's first novel was published in the early 1980s. Since then, he's written more than 35 novels. Many of them are westerns. Today, we're going to talk about a few highlights from his long career. We'll also talk about some nonfiction he's working on. Specifically, he's writing a biography of Louis L'Amour. As I said, Tim Champlin has been writing for decades. Some novels were originally published years ago in print by traditional publishing houses. Now those books are reappearing as ebooks. We're going to start out talking about one of those called Treasure of the Templars. Tim Champlin, welcome to Around It About.
Thank you.
The premise of Treasure of the Templars, I'd never heard of anything like this. This is about a medieval order of knights, the Templars, and in the book they've hidden this big fortune in the desert. The Templars, they're that famous order of knights that really did exist back in the medieval era, and they're kind of a favorite of conspiracy theorists because they used to be so rich and powerful. In your novel, they still exist in secret, and again, they've hidden like this big fortune in the desert. The protagonist is an archaeologist. He's searching for the treasure. It's a real genre bender. It's suspense. It's a Western. It's kind of a conspiracy story. Tell me about the inspiration. Why the Knights Templar in the Old West?
I didn't really know what to do with a Templar story. A friend of mine I worked with had been sent overseas to England for a few months and on the job. And when he came back, we were talking, and I said, I need an idea for my next Western. And he said, well, I just read a book about the Templars and their treasure that's disappeared. He says, why don't you write one about that? And I said, well, I don't know how I'm going to stretch that into the American West. I said, that was a medieval order. And how can I do that? Well, we discussed it for maybe an hour or so. And finally, I worked it around to the point where the treasure could be hidden in the early American Southwest and be sought after by this archaeologist. And so that's how the idea kind of came together, and I worked on it and worked on it. And there seems to be a lot of interest in the Knights Templar these days. I don't know why exactly, but I'm grateful for it.
Yeah. Well, you wrote this in, or this was originally published in 2000, and that was before Dan Brown and the Da Vinci Code,
right,
which I think may have something to do with some of the interest. I imagine when it first came out, that was back when people would say who, whereas now if you say Knights Templar, I think people are more aware of who they were and things like that.
Right, right. And there have been quite a few programs on TV that were documentaries about the Knights
History
Templar.
Channel kind of thing.
Yeah, the History Channel. So it was something that's just kind of resurfaced now. I'm glad I got it out when I did. It's not as complicated as the plots that Dan Brown writes, but it was about as good as I could make it at the time. And it seems to have held up pretty well.
Another one of the protagonists in Treasure of the Templars is a former monk named Marcus Flood. He's really interesting because he goes straight from leaving his order over some theological questions mm-hmm. to becoming a bodyguard for the professor who's looking for the treasure. So he's like an ex-monk gunslinger. He's such a unique character.
Right. I tried to make a background for him as having been in the frontier cavalry in the 1880s. And then he goes into the monastery. And then he decides after a few months that he's not cut out to be a brother in the Cistercian order. So he comes out of the monastery. And of course, just by chance, I have him meet my protagonist, or actually the professor, who is being attacked by a latter-day group of Knights Templar who want to try to find this treasure also. So it was, I have visited that monastery several times, starting in the late 50s when I was in college. And it was, when I went there on retreats and things. So I was familiar with the layout in Kentucky, where it is, Gethsemane. It was a lot of fun to write and, you know, bringing these characters together. And Marcus Flood is a young enough guy where he can take all the physical abuse and all the physical things that the old professor probably can't take. And so that's how they got together.
Another one of the books that you've written, this one is not a Western, but it's got a really interesting premise. It's called Tom Sawyer and the Ghosts of Summer. It's a time travel book for young adults. Tell me about your take on Tom Sawyer and time travel.
Well, that one was kind of a labor of love. I have always been interested in Mark Twain. I read Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn, of course, like everybody else did when I was between 11 and 13 years old. And at the time, I was living in Missouri, in central Missouri, not in Hannibal. But it was something I had always been interested in time travel. So I thought, well, I'm going to get into the mind of this 12-year-old. He falls into a coma after contracting typhoid fever, which was a real problem even in 1950 when this story is set. He goes back in time to 1848 Hannibal and meets Tom and Huck and Aunt Polly and Jim and some of the characters that Twain created. He also meets a 12-year-old Sam Clemens Sam is coexisting with the characters he later created. So he saves Sam Clemens' life, saves him from drowning, and also preserves Mark Twain so he can grow up and write the books that he wrote. Actually, he saves those masterpieces for history because he saves Twain as a little boy when he's Sam Clemens.
Well, I think that's something that people often wonder about. Where do writers get their ideas from? And it sounds like in this one you kind of told the story of where Mark Twain might have gotten some of his ideas. For you, how did you first get interested in Westerns? Because you've written so many of them. What inspired you to write about the West?
Well, when I was growing up, I went to high school in Arizona at St. Mary's High School in Phoenix. And I graduated there in 1955 before my dad was transferred to Tennessee. I always liked the West. I liked the history of the West. I knew a lot about the history of the West and its geography. Also, a lot about the characters that inhabited the 19th century West. So when after I had been writing articles for magazines for a few years, I wanted to try my hand at a novel. I wasn't a good enough historian to write straight history, but I thought I can use a lot of history in fiction and combine them and blend them. And well, I thought since I didn't know anybody in the publishing industry, how was I to get started? This was before computers, before you had a lot of things available, you know, that authors have now. So I said, well, I'll write a category novel. Well, I didn't know anything about science fiction or romance I knew something about Westerns. After I eliminated all the possibilities of category novels, I thought, well, I'll try a Western. And I'd work on it, and I'd put it aside. Finally finished it after about 2 years. And I thought, well, I started sending out a sample chapter. I would Xerox a sample chapter and a cover letter telling what other things I'd had published, mostly short things, send it out to a particular publisher, get a rejection back, and do the same thing over and over and over. Finally, I sent it out to Valentine Books, which is a subsidiary of Random House. It didn't come back. Nothing came back. So I just finally forgot about it and went on with other things. Well, about 9 months later, right out of the blue, and one day I got a letter in the mail from an editor, and she said, I don't know where this manuscript has been floating around our office in New York for 9 months, but she said, it's finally landed on my desk. And she said, I like it, and I would like to see the rest of the manuscript, if you dare to send it.
Oh, wow.
So I thought, well, it took me 6 weeks to type on a manual typewriter. I'm not going to send her the original. So
yeah,
Xeroxed the entire manuscript, mailed it off to her. And I was waiting and waiting. Well, in the meantime, Bantam Books, which was Louis L'Amour's publisher, was having a contest for the best first Western novel. And the first and only prize was $10,000 and a movie contract. And
I thought, well,
that would be worth shooting for.
Yeah.
But you could not have it under consideration by a publisher at the time of the contest. So I waited and waited. The deadline was coming up to enter the contest, March 31st. And I waited till about a week before that. And finally, I sat down and wrote a letter to the editor at Valentine and asked her if she would please set this aside because I wanted to enter this contest. I was right up front with her. And before I mailed the letter, I took it to work. I didn't have a stamp for it. I took it to work with me, and I said, I'll run across the street at lunchtime and put a stamp on it. And before lunchtime came, my wife called and said, the lady from Valentine called, and she wants to buy your book. So I still have the letter, actually, after all these years. I was thrilled to death. And she called me back later that night at home, and we spoke for about an hour and a half, and she offered me an advance and so forth and so on, and we got all the details straightened out, and then she mailed a contract. So that's how I got my foot in the door with Ballantine, and later published another 7 novels with them before they dropped novels when they were bought by Bertelsmann, a big German publisher, and they did away with their Western line. But by then, I'd moved on to other things, so that's how I got into Westerns.
That's Tim Champlin. He's a very prolific author who lives in the area. He's working on a biography of another very prolific Western writer, Louis L'Amour. Coming up on the second half of the show, we'll talk about that. Stay tuned.
Support comes from Electric Bike Specialists, now open in the Soho Building at 45 East Main Street, offering rentals, sales, and service for electric assist bicycles. More information online at electricbikespecialist.com.
Used car prices remain high, so demand has never been greater. Donating your car to WTC means more benefits to us than ever before. Call 855-WUTC-CAR or go online at WUTCCAR.org and donate the vehicle that you no longer want. Whether it's new or old, WUTC will benefit from your generosity.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Tim Champlin. He's written more than 35 books, including Treasure of the Templars and Tom Sawyer and the Ghosts of Summer. Here's more of our conversation. If you're a musician right now and you had an album that came out 15 years ago and it's gone out of print, chances are the record label is still going to own all the rights to it, and so you as the musician would have no power to do anything with it. Whereas as an author, it seems like now if you've got a book that went out of print 10 years ago, you can go ahead and release it yourself as an ebook. It seems like you've got a lot more power as an author these days.
Right. I think authors now have much more choice as far as what they can do. I have a lot of my older books being put up online as ebooks by a company called Crossroads Press in Eastern North Carolina, and it's a good thing. I mean, ebooks are cheaper if you've got a Kindle or something to download them with. It's a lot cheaper than trying to buy a hardback or trying to get it from the library if there's a waiting list of 30 people, although there usually isn't a big waiting list for mine. But I've had some problems with a former agent that as far as copyrights were concerned. And I joined the National Writers Union for a year, and then I joined the Authors Guild, which is another national, and got some assistance from some attorneys at those unions. So I think I've got it pretty well straightened out, but the legal end of it is the least interesting of it for me, really, because I want to use whatever time I have to create stories, and I'll figure out all the legalities of it later or let somebody else do it.
You're writing a biography of Louis L'Amour, one of the most famous Western writers of all time, maybe the most famous Western author of all time. How did this come about? Because it sounds like you've had some things in common with him, some parallels throughout your life a little bit.
Right. I first met Louis L'Amour. Well, actually, I first saw him when he came to Nashville to promote his new novel, Bendigo Shafter, which came out in 1979. And I saw him there, and I knew what he looked like. And he was 70 years old then, but he was just, very vibrant type of person. He was kind of the character that you see in his books. The following year, about 3 months after my first book was accepted by Ballantine, I ran into him again when he came to Nashville on a book tour, told him about my book, and he was just as glad about it as if I had been a professional like he was, instead of a beginner. And he wrote to a fellow writer, Louis L'Amour, Tim Champlin, to a fellow writer in one of the books I bought, and I was a fan of his from then on. Until his death at the age of 80 in 1988. But actually, how I got to write this book, I had never thought about writing a nonfiction, you know, full-length book. A friend of mine who had been talking to Voyager Press about another type of book, he had mentioned to one of the editors that, you know, when he found out they were doing a series of books like this, he was contacted to do one about Mark Twain and the river. So he mentioned my name as far as being a good one to write the one about Louis L'Amour. Well, they contacted me later and asked me if I would be interested. My first instinct was to say no, because this is not really in my field. But I said, yes, I'll do it. And it's actually called Louis L'Amour's Wild West, and it's the way he used things in the 19th century that were correct and true, you know, guns, horses, wagons, landscape, other real famous people that were, you know, actually lived in the West. And so what I did was to write it from that perspective. I read a lot of his books, took a lot of notes, and then wrote it up chapter by chapter, like the lay of the land would be the geography. And he did how he treated women in his stories, and how he treated Indians, and guns and gunfighters. And he had met some of the older men who were still alive, you know, from the early days, and remembered those days. So he's probably the last person. I mean, his generation would have been the last ones to know a lot of the early West gunfighters. And then I did a little thing on the history of firearms and how they developed from black powder to cartridges and so forth. And so it was, that's the kind of approach we took with it. And it was a lot of fun. And how, oh, also I had to treat toward the end of the book how he became famous when there were a lot of other Western writers out there.
Oh, yes.
How he became one of the best-selling authors of all time in any genre. And so I traced that, and I said there's still an element of mystery about how he became as famous as he did. It was a combination of circumstances. He came along when there were probably two or three dozen TV Westerns going, and everybody liked Western movies, and it was at the end of the pulp magazine era and the beginning of the paperback era. And so he hit it just at the right time, and he was a tremendously hard worker. He did three books a year for 30 years for Bantam, and that they remained his publisher for, you know, all of his career. His books are still selling well, and you know, he's a kind of a household name.
Absolutely.
But it's just amazing. There were other contemporaries of his who wrote Westerns probably just as good or better in quality, and several of them put out a lot more, you know, product. A lot more books were issued by some of these other people who never became as famous as he did. I think it's kind of a mystery as to how this all came about. You know, the fame is more than the sum of its parts sometimes, so you never know.
Well, thank you so much for speaking with us. I know if you just go on to Amazon, for example, and search for your name, you'll come up with tons of your books. Do you have like a central website or Facebook or anything like that?
Actually, I'm on Facebook, and I'm in the process of building a website. I have not finished it. I am not technically, well, I'm technically challenged, I guess you could say. I was born 40 years too soon to grow up with computers and know them intimately, but with the help of my kin who know more about this than I do, that I'm trying to build a website. Some of the books that are out of print now that are on Amazon, I have extra copies. If somebody just wants to email me, I can send it to them. You know, it's for now anyway. And I have a lot up as ebooks, and I'm getting more all the time.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you very much for having me.
Again, that was Tim Champlin. He's a prolific writer who lives in the area. Here are just a few of his books. Annie and the Ripper, a historical novel in which Annie Oakley fights Jack the Ripper. Treasure of the Templars, a Western novel about the search for medieval treasure that's been hidden in the Old West. Tom Sawyer and the Ghosts of Summer, a time travel book exploring the early years and inspiration of Mark Twain. Also, as we said in the interview, Champlin is working on a Louis L'Amour book, scheduled for release in the summer of 2015. Many of Tim Champlin's books are on Amazon.com, either the original hardcover or paperback, as well as new ebook versions. You are listening to Around It About Chattanooga.